For the World's podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Running a small business is a lot of work. It takes time and money, and you want all the time and money you have to go towards growing your business. But what happens when legal hurdles pop up along the way? LegalZoom is there to help. Get advice for running your business from vetted independent attorneys and tax professionals available in all 50 states. The best part is you won't get charged by the hour since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan at LegalZoom.com now and get special savings when you enter the word world at checkout. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com.
Before we start the show, we have some news. Today is the first day of our spring fundraiser. We need 150 listeners like you to make a gift in any amount to help us unlock $30,000 in challenge funds. Visit theworld.org/gift to make your gift. And thanks for your support. An historic fire in Paris, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Parisians watch in horror today as the Cathedral of Notre Dame goes up in flames.
The fire has taken place around the roof area. You can see smoke, black smoke, just billowing from the top of this iconic church.
Also, shocking details of Argentina's dirty war are declassified by the U.S. Plus, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar is the target of increasingly hostile rhetoric from the White House and others.
The Islamophobes and the right wing see her as a threat, and they're doing everything and by any means possible to take her down, unfortunately.
And how Atlanta is convincing conservative Georgia to support green energy. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The news today was interrupted mid-afternoon by haunting images from Paris. Bright orange flames bursting through the roof of Notre Dame Cathedral and engulfing the church's spire. The spire then collapsed. So did the expansive roof as onlookers gasped in horror. Unreal and heart-stopping scenes today of one of the world's most iconic cultural sites, a place where Napoleon was once crowned emperor. Joining us from Paris to describe what's been going on there today is reporter Cindy Palm. Cindy, what have you seen? How big is this fire?
The fire is absolutely huge, and Notre Dame is really in the heart of Paris, so it really dominates the surrounding area. And what I've learned, according to a police source, is that the fire broke out around the roof area. There's been construction that has been going on there for months now. I remember seeing it even as far back as last year. So there's a lot of scaffolding in that area. And according to the source, there are no injuries, thankfully. And at this time, authorities don't believe that this is at all related to terrorism. And there will obviously be a full investigation to determine what caused the fire. But this is the information that we know at this time.
And what would you say Notre Dame actually kind of represents in the imagination of the French people?
It represents Paris. This is a medieval Catholic cathedral located in the Île de Cité, which is one of the kind of islands in the middle of Paris. So it's associated with Paris, and it's one of the finest examples of French Gothic architecture.
I mean, it's extraordinary. People are aghast on social media at the sight of these flames. One person on Twitter even said it felt like it was the end of the world. What did it mean to you, Cindy, as you saw the first images of this iconic structure on fire?
Well, even when I first came to Paris years ago and just walking in the heart of Paris, this is the building that stands out. It looks completely different. I marveled at it. I looked at it and I said, wow, no, it's beautiful. Near the top, there's an area where you can go. And I was just there just a little while ago. And it is one of the most beautiful. Actually, I think it's the most beautiful view of Paris. So I think I, like everyone else, it's incredible to see it just going up in smoke.
Reporter Cindy Palma in Paris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Turning to other news now. It is often hard to tell what's real and what's not when it comes to the Trump administration's immigration policy. Going into last weekend, administration officials had dismissed a plan to release immigrant detainees into sanctuary cities, only to have the president himself revive the idea.
They want more people in their sanctuary cities? Well, we'll give them more people. We can give them a lot.
The White House says the president likes the plan, which would involve taking released detainees to sanctuary cities, cities that tend to have Democrats in leadership positions. But remember, President Trump has long been critical of the whole sanctuary cities concept. Here he is just last December.
Unfortunately, there are extreme politicians in cities and states around America, I'm sure you haven't heard about this, who have issued policies to forbid their police departments from working with federal immigration authorities. Hard to believe, isn't it?
Let's get straight to the facts with the world's Monica Campbell in California. She's on the immigration beat for us. Here's how she describes what being in a sanctuary city actually means.
If you're an undocumented immigrant in a place like San Francisco or New York City, and you're charged with a crime, like a low-level crime, a nonviolent crime, then you won't be turned over to ICE or immigration agents and face deportation back to a country that you haven't lived in for many, many, many years. So that is what Trump is talking about mostly when he refers to sanctuary policy.
And there in California, Monica, you're surrounded by a number of sanctuary cities. What's the conversation there on all of this?
In terms of Trump's proposal to have migrants sent to sanctuary cities, the response was immediately, yes, we welcome migrants in places like Oakland and San Francisco. These are not people to fear. But the second response is that this is a distraction from deeper challenges about migration, about the root causes of migration, particularly from Central America, and that it's wrong for the president to use people as pawns to punish his opponents at a time like this.
Is this proposal, idea, whatever it is it feasible? Could it ever become actual policy?
It's doubtful. It also overlooks how migration works. So right now, migrants are being sent to transit centers like bus stations near the border because they often have a family member somewhere in the country where they're going to go and head and meet. So they're going elsewhere in the country. So you could spend a lot of money to send somebody, an asylum seeker or a migrant, to Seattle and then have them get on a bus to go to Chicago or Houston where they're going to go anyway.
Mm. So this whole moving migrants to sanctuary cities, I mean, it could be a distraction, one that needs to be taken seriously, though. At the same time, there is a lot of noise with all the rhetoric and policies that are coming out of Washington about immigration. What are you paying attention to?
Well, I'm paying attention to how the administration could return to some form of family separation. We've been hearing for several months about what's called a binary choice policy. That's how it's being termed in the administration, to put it sort of in a way we can all understand. It kind of puts the question of separation, family separation, to the parents. So let's say you're a family and you arrive at the border. The choice would be, do you want to be detained in a detention center with your kids, perhaps for a lengthy amount of time? Or do you want them to be released to a relative in the U.S. or to a shelter? So that is a choice that the administration has floated as being put to the parents. I am following that because it is something that the administration keeps going back to kind of somewhat quietly, but there could be some openings for that.
So what is the immediate concern, like today, Monday, for migrants at the border?
An immediate concern is to be in a safe place in the world with your family. That's what you hear. That's what I hear often from people at the border, that they want stability in their lives, that they want to be able to work and start to send money back home to their loved ones and to stay together as a family. So those are the things you hear. Of course, there's also confusion about what are the policies? What are they going to come up against when they reach the border? And a lot of people are in some ways in the dark about that. They don't have lawyers. But the first and foremost concern is I want to be safe and I want to be with my family.
The world's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, speaking with us from the Bay Area. Thanks very much, Monica.
You're welcome.
Powered by 100% carbon-free energy. That is the goal for a growing list of cities around the world trying to fight the global climate crisis. A few of those cities have made big progress. Reykjavik, Iceland. Burlington, Vermont, to name a couple. Others are just getting started, like Atlanta, where this is a big challenge. But as former VP Al Gore once said, if Atlanta can get to 100% green energy, anybody can. Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
Like any other city, Atlanta is woven with power lines, trams, and buses. The electricity that makes Atlanta run comes mostly from coal, natural gas, and nuclear energy. Only about 6 to 8% comes from renewable sources.
And so obviously going from that number to 100% by 2035 is a bold goal.
Amol Naik is Atlanta's chief resilience officer. He says the green energy plan just approved by the city council to get to 100% green in 16 years is, quote, ambitious and achievable. But he admits there's no easy path to get there.
There's no five-run home run or four-point shot. This is something that needs to happen in an incremental way. It's a lot of folks sitting around a table figuring out the best way forward.
So how exactly will those folks increase Atlanta's green energy supply from 8% to 100% in just 16 years? They're going to start by trying to use less energy.
There's an awful lot of low-hanging fruit left.
Matt Cox is the CEO of the Greenland Group. He helped craft Atlanta's new plan. Cox says you start with the basics, insulating old homes, installing energy-efficient lights, and better cooling and heating systems.
We identified an opportunity to reduce the consumption in the city 25 to 30% just through the energy efficiency side alone.
And Cox says studies found there's another benefit to investing in efficiency.
They were showing internal rate of return of over 60%. That's 60%.
But efficiency is just a start. Atlanta's plan also relies on putting up a lot more solar panels on homes, commercial buildings, and at utility-scale solar farms. It banks on things like improved battery storage for solar energy and buying renewable energy credits from outside the state to offset coal and gas power still coming from the local grid. Atlanta's mix will also still include a lot of nuclear, a controversial power source for environmentalists. But however the city tries to reach its goal, Atlanta will need the cooperation of some key players who aren't so gung-ho on the plan. People like Lauren Bubba McDonald.
Well, I guess you would say it's a nice dream. In country talk, it's pretty good fodder. But fodder doesn't feed much, you know.
McDonald chairs the Georgia Public Service Commission, which oversees Atlanta's electric utility. Don't get him wrong. McDonald supports solar energy. When I met him, he was wearing a bright yellow shirt. He says with falling prices, a sunny climate, and ample space for solar farms, solar makes sense in Georgia.
The sun will be here 80 years from now. And I'll bet you, if you want to make a bet right now, I bet you that it'll be shining just as bright 80 years from now as it is today.
But McDonald also says there are limits. If Atlanta were to paper itself with solar panels, that might meet only a quarter of the city's energy needs. McDonald is a free market guy, so he doesn't like mandates or subsidies to increase the mix of green energy. He's not especially concerned about the growing threat of climate change either.
I'm not going to sit here and just say it's a bunch of buoy, because there may be some cause in it. But this earth has been on here a long time, and I'm a Christian, and I know who's in charge.
So to get its green plan off the ground, Atlanta will need to sell it to regulators like McDonald and lawmakers in the state's conservative legislature.
You don't lead with climate change. You lead with, let's provide economic development for the entire state.
I rode Atlanta's subway with a former state representative, Stephanie Stuckey. Stuckey is now the director of sustainability with Atlanta's South Face Institute. She says building a political coalition for green energy means focusing on jobs.
Actually, all of the areas where we are building large-scale industrial solar arrays in Georgia are in rural communities. And the economic development and the local government leaders who are embracing these projects are by and large conservative. And they're not talking about climate change. They're talking
Atlanta's green energy plan touts the creation of 8,000 new jobs in the industry. Backers say the plan could help low-income families in other ways, too.
We know that solar can lower a person's home energy bill.
Chandra Farley is with the nonprofit group Partnership for Southern Equity. She says right now many black households in Atlanta are struggling just to pay their electricity bills. She wants policymakers to help low-income communities by investing in the green plan. She says it's really a matter of priorities.
Atlanta's still pretty segregated, I think, by race and class. You know, the west side of Atlanta, it's right on the other side of the billion-dollar stadium that we have that is
Georgia taxpayers could end up paying $700 million for that gleaming new football stadium. Supporters of the city's green energy plan say that makes their idea sound like a bargain. It's early days. The clean energy blueprint was just approved by the city council in March with no set funding source. But City Hall is making the case that it's not only the right thing to fight climate change in the future, but also to help people in the region right now. For The World, Jason Margolis, Atlanta.
A day of climate protests in London as demonstrators there shut down parts of the city. That's just ahead, right here on The World.
This podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to our podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics with far-reaching implications, from how venture capital is fueling innovation, to the global shift toward renewable energy, to the economic impacts of President Trump's legislative agenda, and more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. This morning, protesters in London parked a bright pink yacht in the middle of Oxford Street, right in the city center. Some even glued themselves to the hull of the boat. The yacht is meant to symbolize rising sea levels caused by climate change. It's one of several protests around London organized by the group Extinction Rebellion. They're demanding action from the British government. The World's Russell Newlove visited one of the protests today.
As I was cycling into work this morning, as I do when the weather allows, I heard the drums and music familiar to anybody who has ever been on a protest. And then about a mile later, as I came up to Oxford Street, there it was, a bright pink boat surrounded by people dressed in costumes. All part of this Extinction Rebellion group who want the government to take action on climate change.
How many people were there? And was this planned or did it kind of surprise everybody?
No, it's definitely been planned. Extinction Rebellion are a relatively new group, but they are very organised. They've set up in 5 different locations today, and they intend to stay there at least 2 weeks. One of the organisers was addressing the crowd, asking for people to come and man these stations through the cold, dark hours, as he called them. There was only around about 500 people, maybe 1,000, where I was. It's hard to say how many people will actually see it through for 2 weeks.
So what is this group Extinction Rebellion actually hoping to accomplish this week?
So they have 3 core demands. For the government to tell the truth about climate change, reduce carbon emissions to zero by 2025, and to create a citizens' assembly to oversee progress. When I was speaking to one of the organisers earlier, he stressed the importance of civil disobedience.
Unless it's inconvenient to somebody, then it's not going to make a difference. So we're here to literally hold up the traffic. We feel that if we can disrupt life in London, whilst we're trying to make a point and whilst we're trying to say things, that's going to make a much bigger impact than the protest marches we've all been going on for the last 10 years.
But by their own admission, they are troublemakers. This isn't their first stunt. You might remember just a couple of weeks ago, the group staged a naked protest in Parliament during the Brexit debates. They've poured fake blood outside the Houses of Commons. They've smashed windows at the Shell building deliberately to take their case to court so that they can advertise their group and the advocacy that they stand for.
So when Londoners hear that Extinction Rebellion is about to stage another protest, is that a good thing for people who are concerned about climate change? I mean, how do they react?
It's a good thing for people worried about climate change. Many people agree that not enough is being done, and with other things in the news, like Brexit, which is basically paralysing the political system, nothing is getting done. No bills are being considered to do anything about pollution. Meanwhile, pollution goes up in London by the day. I think people agree with it in spirit, but after 2 weeks of disruption, we'll have to see.
The World's Russell Newlove there in London. The Librarian of Auschwitz is a book by Antonio Iturbe that tells the extraordinary story of a 14-year-old girl at Auschwitz who's given a big responsibility by her fellow prisoners there. She's entrusted to look after a small library of books smuggled into the concentration camp. The girl's name is Dita Kraus, and she turns 90 this year. My BBC colleague Rebecca Jones has her story.
A book helps to forget reality. And for Dieter Kraus, reality was almost unbearable. She lived a comfortable and carefree life with her Jewish parents in Prague. And then they were all sent to Auschwitz in 1943.
We were constantly aware of the gas chambers because we could see the chimneys. The air was full of ash flakes like snow. We could smell the burnt flesh of the crematoria. We knew that this will be our end also. Killed like insects.
But in Block 31, a secret school for children had been established. Books were forbidden, but a few, found among the luggage of arrivals in Auschwitz, were smuggled past the guards. It was Dieter Kraus's job to look after them.
Well, I was sitting there on a little stool, and in front of me I had a bench where the books stood, and the teachers came and borrowed them from me.
And do you remember any of the books in particular?
I do remember one for certain, H.G. Wells, A Short History of the World. But many of them were not books to read, but it was an atlas and books that the children couldn't understand, Russian grammar, among others. But they used it for all kinds of games they could play with the letters of the pages.
Among the other tattered books were Freud's interpretation of dreams and The Count of Monte Cristo. And the existence of the little library remained largely a secret until now.
Nobody knew. Nobody cared and nobody knew. Most people, after the war, when we started telling them what we experienced, nobody wanted to listen.
But Dieter Kraus wants to be heard. Her father died of starvation a few weeks after arriving in Auschwitz. He was 44.
He just became thinner and thinner and couldn't get up from his bunk. And he died in the night. And my mother was ill at the time. She was on the isolation ward because she had diphtheria. But I couldn't go in, so I called it through the wall to my mother that father died.
And Dieter Kraus's own fate ultimately lay in the hands of the notorious Nazi doctor Josef Mengele, who conducted horrific experiments on children in the camp. It was he who decided whether she lived or died, and she would lie to survive.
We had to strip upper body and stand in front of him when he selected people for work in Germany. Women of 16 to 40 were allowed to go for the selection. I wasn't 16, I was 15. We had to say our age and profession. I said age 16, profession painter. He stopped. He asked me, portrait painter or house painter? I said, portrait painter. He continued, could you paint my portrait? I was terribly frightened, but I said, jawohl, yes. He smiled with half his mouth and sent me to the group chosen for work. All the others were all sent to their death in July 1944.
Dieter, a final question. Books have been important to you all your life. What's it like now that you have a book with your name on it?
It pleases me, of course, but I'm not proud to be a survivor because I did nothing special that allowed me to live. But I'm a representative of the others somehow. I would like to teach people not to hate. Teach them to be friendly and accept the other. That's the main thing.
Holocaust survivor Dieter Kraus, now 90 years old, the one-time librarian of Auschwitz. Ending that report by the BBC's Rebecca Jones. A quick note before we get back to the show. This is the first day of our spring fundraiser here at The World. Listener donations help us meet the cost of sending our reporters all over the globe, from Saudi Arabia to Antarctica to the U.S.-Mexico border. We need the support of 150 listeners like you to help us unlock $30,000 in challenge funds that will help us to be on the ground wherever the next story takes us. Visit theworld.org/gift to make your gift. And thanks for your support.
I'm
I'm Marco Werman. The NBA reaches out to Latino fans and tries to recruit more Latino players.
It's something that I just carry with me every day, and I understand the responsibility, you know, that's on my shoulders. And it's something that, you know, that I'm proud of, to be a Latino.
Latino hoop dreams, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Trump administration has not been keen to share classified documents, but there are exceptions. Take what happened on Friday. That's when the U.S. government handed over the final batch of some 47,000 documents to Argentina. Military, diplomatic, and intelligence cables, all previously classified. The documents cover Argentina's so-called dirty war of the 1970s and 80s, a period that resulted in the deaths of 10,000 people, real and perceived anti-government activists. Carlos Osorio was key to the declassification effort. He directs the Southern Cone Documentation Project at the non-governmental National Security Archive.
You see riveting documentation like the capture and disappearance of Roberto Quieto, a Montonero leader in early 1976, who is captured. He's been tortured by a unit. I think it's the federal police. And after they are done with him, they are about to kill him. And then the military intelligence intervenes and says, no, they're not going to kill him. We want to interrogate him. The federal police is so pissed off that they poison this person, trying to kill him.
And remind us who he was?
Roberto Quieto was the deputy leader of the Montoneros in Argentina in 1976. The Montoneros were the largest Argentina guerrilla movement in the 1970s. They were practically exterminated between 1976 and 1977.
Did these assassination squads operate with the blessings of the CIA?
That is speculation. There's no documentary evidence regarding this. What is interesting, though, is that the CIA and the FBI, they had liaison programs going on with these intelligence agencies, so they were able to document what they were doing. They were gathering the information and passing it on to the diplomatic and policymakers. What the policymakers did with that information is one of the big questions that is missing from this release. What these documents show is the shocking detail of information that was feeding the policymakers.
What was one of the cables you read that really kind of stunned you?
I was telling you about Roberto Quieto, how they poison him and they make him survive to continue torturing him. There is Marcos Osatinsky, a descendant from the Montoneros, who was killed in 1975. He was killed, and then the family recovers the body, and they are going to bury him. And some members of the police, of the Cordoba police, who actually kidnap the corpse because they don't want anybody doing an autopsy because they are going to realize how badly this person was tortured.
That's unreal. Of course, many Argentines were taken out over the ocean and dropped into the sea. Will these documents help Argentine officials who are hoping to still prosecute the surviving masterminds of the dirty war? Will it help them in those prosecutions?
Absolutely. This will also bring justice into several dozens of cases. Not the thousands of cases, but dozens of cases that can be documented. You can introduce documents into these trials, and these documents are crucial.
These documents were delivered as part of a deal struck during the final months of Obama's presidency. Here's Obama during his 2016 visit to Argentina, still as president, announcing the project.
It takes courage for a society to address uncomfortable truths about the darker parts of its past, confronting crimes committed by our own leaders, by our own people. That can be divisive and frustrating, but it's essential to moving forward.
So, Carlos, the release of these documents is a legacy of the Obama presidency. Were you wondering at all whether the Trump administration was going to go through with the release of these documents? Did the current administration, do you know, ever consider scrapping it?
I do not know that for a fact, but we worried. Yes, we worried. Usually what happens with this kind of projects is that they have so much political, diplomatic meaning to the counterpart, in this case the Argentine government, that the interest of the United States is well served by responding to that interest of President Macri in this case. President Macri has really adopted this as a nation-building, memory-building project. It's very interesting what the language is coming from a government that is not usually on the side of the human rights investigations. But that is very impressive from the Macri administration, who continued showing the interest on having this project come to fruition. Forgiveness, be it from one side or the other, is based on the truth, and that is what these documents contribute to.
Carlos Osorio with the National Security Archive in Washington. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
It is not uncommon for U.S. government agencies to conceal documents that show links to corrupt regimes. That bothers Representative Norma Torres. She's a Southern California Democrat and the only member of Congress who was born in Central America. This summer, Torres helped pass an anti-corruption initiative that asked the State Department to provide Congress with a list of corrupt government officials in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. The list was supposed to include all officials who were known to have committed acts of corruption or who have been involved in drug trafficking and illicit campaign financing. But when the State Department provided the list to Congress this month, Representative Torres was unimpressed.
Frankly, the list was a sham. It was a sham because the names that were included on that list are people that have already been indicted, might have already been arrested, and that is not what Congress asked. So by covering up, by not producing a full list of corrupt elected officials within the Northern Triangle region of Central America, they are, in essence, involved in a cover-up that is just and is the reason why so many people are fleeing the country.
What would this list be covering up?
The list will be covering up elected officials such as members of the parliament within these countries that are themselves involved in narco trafficking. For example, you know, we have a Honduran president whose brother was arrested for being a narco trafficker. He was indicted, actually, for being a narco trafficker. So that is someone who I expected to be on the list, among other people that I'd rather not share openly. But they know, the State Department has full knowledge of who these people are, and that is what Congress asked of them to supply, but they did not.
So you're certain that there are more names that ought to be on this list. Do you think the list is intentionally incomplete? And if so, why?
I think it's intentionally incomplete. And the reason why I think that is because in my subcommittee, when I began to question Secretary Pompeo on this,
are you aware that on November 26, 2018, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York indicted Juan Antonio Hernandez Alvaro, President Hernandez's brother, on drug trafficking charges?
Yes.
So according to the indictment, Mr. Hernandez had access to cocaine labs in Honduras and Colombia. Are you confident that President Hernandez was unaware that his brother is an alleged narco trafficker?
There was a pause, you know, in his response.
May I answer that for you in a different forum, please? Just there's ongoing. Anyway, I just prefer to do that if that's acceptable.
He refused to answer that question openly. You know, what other information do they have that could be available even in a classified setting? The bottom line is the situation in our southern border is critical. And the reason for that is because we have provided no political support for UN organizations such as CSIG that has been tasked with investigating major issues of public corruption in Guatemala. And in Honduras, we looked the other way when President Hernandez was reelected in an election that, you know, had a lot of problems, that it was a fraudulent reelection.
Did you ever get to sit down with Secretary Pompeo, and did he give you the information you wanted?
Not yet. My office is following up with him now, and we're trying to get a classified briefing from him.
Congresswoman, at the same time that you're pushing the anti-corruption campaign in Central America, the Trump administration, as you know, is cutting off funds to Guatemala as well as El Salvador and Honduras as kind of punishment for not doing more to, as the White House claims, stop migrants from fleeing to the U.S. Are you worried that having a full list of corrupt officials in these countries could add weight to the White House argument that these funds ought to be cut?
Look, we need to stop sending them military equipment, and we need to stop training military officials. We need to stop training police officers. I support having that assistance. What I do not support, and I think that we are headed in a wrong direction, is cutting humanitarian aid. But on the issue of the military, training military personnel, I'm very concerned about that. I'm very concerned about sending military equipment like the Jeeps that we gave them last year. And on August 31st of 2018 in Guatemala, they utilized those Jeeps to intimidate our U.S. embassy in Guatemala and to intimidate the U.N. personnel at the CSIG offices. That's not acceptable. And what did the Trump administration do after that? 4 weeks later, they sent four more vehicles.
Representative Norma Torres, Democrat from California. She's a member of the House Appropriations and Rules Committees. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being with you today.
Another congresswoman in the news, Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. Last month, Omar gave a speech at the Council on American-Islamic Relations, also known as CARE. In that speech, she said this.
CARE was founded after 9/11 because they recognized that some people did something and that all of us were starting to lose access to our civil liberty. So you
those lines, some people did some things, were seized by Omar's critics. On Friday, the New York Post published a front-page image of the Twin Towers in flames alongside Omar's words, suggesting that she underplayed the seriousness of what happened on 9/11. President Trump tweeted a video montage of 9/11 footage spliced with Omar's comments. He added, "We will never forget," in all caps. The Yemeni community in New York City is riled up and defensive of Omar. The Yemeni owners of bodegas, those little neighborhood grocery stores, they're now boycotting the New York Post. Debbie Almontasser is the co-founder of the Yemeni American Merchants Association. She's been involved in the boycott.
It came about by members of our merchants who simply just called and said, you know, we are outraged about this. We can't believe what we're seeing. The Yemeni American community has an affinity for her because her mother is Yemeni. And so we have this special connection to her. And so they called and said, we're outraged, you know, what can we do? And we said, well, what would you like to do? And, you know, some of them said, we want to boycott the paper. Our board members contacted 10 influential Yemeni American merchants who own between 5 and 10 small businesses, which we call bodegas and delis here in New York City. And all of them were on board.
How do you know there is a link between this front page of the New York Post and a rise in Islamophobic attacks?
Well, we see that every day. You know, whenever there is negative publicity promoted by the media, we hear of reports of hate crimes in our communities. I'm sure that you probably saw what happened in a New Jersey school where a girl's hijab was actually pulled off on Friday. And it's been, you know, circulating the news. We've seen Representative Ilhan Omar herself receive death threats and actually had someone here from New York who actually said they will put a bullet through her skull. And this man has actually been arrested and indicted.
I guess what I'm trying to say is back to your point that this happens every day. So how, I mean, there was just the New Zealand Christchurch mosque shootings, which led to Islamophobic threats and attacks here in the United States. So how do you know this front page is responsible for these particular threats?
Well, I mean, again, I've just answered it for you. We see that, right, in the reports of hate crimes and, you know, bigotry against people. And sadly, within our communities, you know, some people are too afraid to report these things. And I think the position and the stand that the Yemeni American Merchants Association has taken right now is one that is very brave and is widely being supported, not only by the American Muslim community, but nationally on a whole. I can't begin to tell you the messages that we're getting on Facebook, the messages I'm getting personally of commending us for doing this. And we are going to remain steadfast in our demands and making sure that this boycott campaign against the New York Post will continue for the next 30 days until we hear from them. And if we don't hear from them on our demands, we are ready to take further action.
What further action?
So further action is actually identifying some of their advertisers and getting their advertisers to pull out. For example, you have Mercedes and Nordstrom's, and we are saying to them, you are directly subsidizing hate. And we are requesting of them to choose between their customers around the world and this agent of hate and violence, the New York Post.
Your demands are pretty high. I mean, removal of an editor-in-chief at the New York Post. I mean, it was the New York Post, we should remember, that put this front page out, a quote out of context and picture of the World Trade in flames on 9/11. Rupert Murdoch, a good friend of the president, owns the Post. Does that worry you?
You know, it doesn't worry us. It doesn't worry us. We're going to continue steadfast. And, you know, we have to demand the removal of Stephen Lynch, the editor-in-chief. Allowing his reporters to put something out like this is very irresponsible. It is inciting hate. It is inciting violence. It is putting Congresswoman Ilhan Omar's life in danger, as well as American Muslim women who look like her.
But this also goes beyond the New York Post. I mean, the president of the United States is tweeting things in a very same vein.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we hope that our message of boycotting the New York Post is going to send a message to him that he needs to be more responsible as the leader of this nation.
Debbie Almentasser, the co-founder of the Yemeni American Merchants Association. Thanks very much for talking about this boycott.
Thank you so much for having me.
We contacted the New York Post for comment. We did not receive a response before going to air. Basketball fans all over the globe are in heaven right now. I'm feeling it because the NBA playoffs are finally underway. And they started with a dominant display from the team with the best regular season record, the Milwaukee Bucks, and their undisputed star, Giannis Antetokounmpo.
How about Giannis? He can't and he won't and he don't stop. The Bucks haven't had a league MVP since Kareem. And with Kareem in attendance, the Greek Freak helps the Bucks win by 35, but he's not done. More from his freakiness.
That clip courtesy of the NBA. I don't know about calling him the Greek Freak, but Antetokounmpo does indeed hail from Greece, with another parent from Nigeria, one of 108 international players in the NBA this season. That is not a record, by the way. There were 113 foreign-born players in the league a couple of years back, part of an unmistakable trend over the past two decades, during which NBA rosters have become more and more international.
The NBA right now is a global league that happens to be based in the United States.
That's Davide Chinilato, NBA editor for La Gazzetta dello Sport in Italy. He says it's not just the fact that 25% of the players in the league are from outside the U.S. It's that many of those international players have become franchise leaders on the court. As Exhibit A, Davide points to German legend Dirk Nowitzki, who just retired after 21 seasons, leading the Dallas Mavericks.
You think about Dirk, who is a legend in Dallas and who was for 21 seasons the face of a franchise. You think about Giannis Antetokounmpo, who has the chance to become the first European MVP since Dirk Nowitzki in 2007. You think about Luka Doncic, who is going to probably be the new face of the Dallas franchise, who is from Slovenia. I guess basketball is becoming more and more like global games, and the NBA is the obvious destination for the best basketball players in the world.
Chinilato also points to the NBA's marketing muscle, which he says is also growing more international. As a result, more and more young fans are tuning in and dreaming of NBA glory, no matter where in the world they are.
Young kids fall in love with the NBA even before they start playing basketball, and the reason they play basketball is the NBA.
That was Davide Chinilato, NBA editor for the Italian sports daily, La Gazzetta dello Sport. While the overall profile of the NBA has been growing more international, Latino fans tuning in for playoff games this month won't see that many Latino or Latin American players on the court, despite the increased importance of Latino audiences for the league. But as Esteban Butillos with station WGBH here in Boston tells us, there is a push to change that.
You can't even begin to talk about Latino basketball players without talking about Manu Ginobili. The Argentinian shooting guard is widely considered the best Latin American player ever. He spent 16 seasons with the San Antonio Spurs, where he won 4 championships. Spurs head coach Greg Popovich says his presence off the court with the Latino community was always something special.
The people here took him in as one of their own, and he allowed it to happen. He's a very warm individual and understood his responsibility to the community.
Ginobili bowed out last year, but the team retired his jersey this March when the Spurs took on the Cleveland Cavaliers at home. Billed as Gracias Manu, the night was a celebration of everything Ginobili and his heritage. Before the game started, an Argentinian singer performed the country's national anthem. And when it was Ginobili's time to talk after the game, he gave a bilingual speech to the sold-out arena. It was a fitting send-off for the NBA's most successful Latin player ever and one of the country's most Latino cities.
The Latino demographic is the one that grows, I believe, the most in the States already.
Arnon DeMello is the vice president and managing director of NBA Latin America. According to the league, Hispanics comprise 17% of the domestic fan base. That's roughly 15 million fans. And in Latin America, NBA programming reaches 51 countries and territories and is broadcast in four different languages. It's even starting to gain ground on that other sport involving a ball and the net.
You know, if you look at the Caribbean and Brazil and Mexico, you see that in that region, basketball clearly is a contender for the number two spot, not only in terms of participation, but also affinity and popularity of the sport, you know, only losing to football.
But as popular as the game is becoming among fans, Latino professional players are still scarce. According to the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sport, the NBA was only 2.3% Latino last season. So along with junior NBA programs in Latin America, the league opened an academy in Mexico City last year to help the best prospects in the region develop. And DeMello says they're working on getting a G League team, the NBA version of a minor league club, set up in the Mexican capital.
So I think the path is there. Is ready, you know, and hopefully we'll see more and more boys and girls, you know, coming out of these programs into the NBA and the WNBA.
This is all a big switch from when Boston Celtics center Al Horford was growing up in the Dominican Republic and basketball was just starting to become popular there. But now it's everywhere.
You go in DR and you drive around and you see everybody, you know, playing basketball, a lot of basketball courts, and people are hungry. You know, they really enjoy basketball.
And Horford is using his own influence to help the game. Last summer, the Celtics big man was part of an initiative to renovate courts in the Dominican Republic.
On my end, one of the things that I want to continue to work on is to continue to help to develop the game over there, so because the passion is there.
Now, as Horford and other Latino players help to carry the torch first lit by people like his father, Tito, who was the first Dominican player in the NBA, and Ginobili, Horford is aware of the example he's setting for the community.
It's something that I just carry with me every day, and I understand the responsibility, you know, that's on my shoulders. And it's something that I embrace. I really enjoy it, and it's something that, you know, that I'm proud of to be a Latino.
For the world, I'm Esteban Bustillos.
Finally today, one of the world's major sporting events took place in our back and front yard here in Boston today. The Boston Marathon. More than 30,000 runners were expected at the start line. And just a couple of hours later, the winners put on a spectacular show in both the men's and women's races. In the women's competition, Ethiopia's Werknesh Degefa commanded the race from the beginning, at one point running more than 4 minutes ahead of her nearest rival. Degefa finished in 2 hours, 23 minutes and 31 seconds. That pace, just under 5.5 minutes per mile. Totally different story in the men's race. With just meters to go before the finish, Lelisa Desisa of Ethiopia was in the lead, with Kenya's Lawrence Chirono bearing down hard. Then Chirono turned on the gas and took the lead just in time to break the tape. A thrilling victory in one of the oldest and most storied marathons in the world. And we're at the finish line. That's where we leave it on this Marathon Monday here in Boston. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.